George Gallon.
My good friend, this almost made me believe I'm a great man with courage. I hate to disabuse him, but I want to tell a story that an editor with whom I was discussing the November 4th election in Texas yesterday, a story that he told. He said, your prediction or your stories on the election remind me of the Vermont farmer. This Vermont farmer was on riding on the train one day with his wife, and the train passed a flock of sheep. The farmer's wife said, John, isn't that a black sheep there? And the farmer said, well, at least he's black on this side. Well, after 1948, I had to explain for 4 years why we were wrong. Now we have to explain why we weren't more nearly right. And I'm hoping that by 1952, I can stand up here before you and tell you why we were so wonderfully accurate. In 1948, we were charged by some of our academic friends with being very reckless. We hadn't pointed out all of the facts of life to our reading public. We hadn't described fully the areas of fact and differentiated these areas of fact from the areas of judgment. Oddly enough, one of the chief criticisms of the work of the Gallup poll this fall and of other polls was that we weren't reckless enough. I mean, that we didn't come out flat-footedly and say that Eisenhower would win. Well, I think probably all of us took too seriously, maybe, the injunctions of the Social Science Research Committee of 1948. As a matter of fact, I think that anyone, borrowing the words of Adlai Stevenson, ought to have his head examined for being in this business anyway. I mean, the election part of it. I never have found any great social good coming from this business of telling the public a few hours or a few days ahead of time what the voters are going to do on a certain Tuesday. But I do think that there is a tremendous value in being able to report what the people of this country think about the vital issues of the day. And that is the full and complete justification for polls. I like to quote James Bryce. He's sort of the patron saint of all of us people in the poll business. I don't know whether many of you have read James Bryce's account of the role of public opinion in a democracy or not. But some 60 years ago, in a book called The American Commonwealth, he pointed out that the obvious weakness of government by public opinion is the difficulty of ascertaining it. And he went on to predict that the next and final development in a democracy would come when the will of the people could be known at all times and without the need of using election machinery. Well, we think that day is rapidly approaching when it is possible to know the will of the people at all times. And interestingly enough, it's not only possible to know what the people of this country think at all times on all the important issues, but it is equally possible to know what the people of the other great democracies of the world think. We can poll this country in something like 24 hours. The same can be done in England, France, and a half a dozen other countries. So it is possible to know what the people do think on the issues that confront the world, at least the democratic world. Now, Bryce came very near designing the first public opinion poll. Bryce, after studying the workings of public opinion in this country, said that the only way that you could discover opinion was to go out and talk to the people. He said it couldn't be done by reading newspapers or other publications. The only way to get opinion was to go out and talk to people, and to go out and talk to people in all walks of life. Now, if he had known anything about the principle of sampling, James Bryce would have worked out the plans, the design, certainly for a public opinion poll back in the year 1890. Well, he thought that he saw the difficulty of reading the will of the people in election returns. What is the mandate of the people from the November 4th election? Do any of you have any clear impression as to what the mandate is in respect to aid to Europe? Was there a mandate in the election to increase the money we send to our friends in Europe? Was it a mandate to reduce the amount? Was it a mandate to give our allies there approximately the same amount they've had in the past? Well, you could call the roll on a great many issues, and you can see how difficult it is to separate public opinion on an issue in contrast to opinion on the candidates. And that is certainly one of the things that can be done in this business of polling. We think that polls have done a great service in this whole matter of deflating pressure groups. Pressure group has only one means by which it can influence legislators, and that is the threat of punishing them at the next election. Many times we've gone in and proved that the spokesmen for various pressure groups do not represent even a majority of their own membership. Time after time we found that, say, the American Legion doesn't speak for its own membership, or labor, or the Chamber of Commerce of the United States. And that is one of the very great services that I think we can and do perform. Now, I think the greatest justification of polls probably is to be found in the record of their findings from 1935 up until this time. The first polls, our polls started in October 1935, been going a little over 17 years. We have polled the country on every important issue in all these years. It's interesting to go back and study the polls and the subsequent action of Congress. One of the first calls we took, we made in the early days. This was in 1935. We found that the public in those early days of the 30s wanted to increase very greatly the size of our expenditures for the armed services, but particularly they wanted to build up the Air Force. Now this was at a time when even our greatest generals and admirals thought that planes would be of secondary importance if a new world war came along. In 1940, 6 months after the start of the war in Europe, the Army asked Congress for 1,200 military planes, and Congress gave them exactly 59. That's why in December of 1941 at Wake Island, there were only 6 aircraft ready there to defend our soldiers, our Marines. Well, I could call the roll on almost every important piece of legislation through the war years and in these post-war years. And you'll find invariably that the public has been ahead of its so-called leaders, and particularly ahead of Congress. A good friend of mine, the publisher of the Washington Post, defines a public leader, a political leader, as a man who's only 6 months behind public opinion. Well, now, a few words quickly about how polls are taken. I'm not going to give you a lot of statistical data. I do want to talk about the election. But first of all, let me give you a very brief review of a picture of how a poll is taken. We do it with interviewers. We have some 1,000 interviewers scattered around the country who, on a part-time basis, take and interview people for us. I go out from time to time myself. I went up to East Stroudsburg this fall. I usually put on a colored shirt. I always hope that no one will identify me, but of course they're always telling me that this fellow Gallup better be right this time. I remember being up in Lisbon, Maine, in an earlier election, and I interviewed a man who'd been interviewed by one of my associates just a few minutes before, and this associate of mine had given him his name, so this man immediately demanded to know my name. Well, not being very fast on my feet, I said, well, my name is Gallup, and he looked me over carefully from head to toe, and he said, a relative, I suppose. And one of my favorite stories came from that same experience in Lisbon. I interviewed a woman who, I knocked on the door, and this woman came to the door, and I said I was in the Gallup poll, and she said, well, she'd heard of the Gallup poll, but this is the first time she'd ever seen anyone from the Gallup poll. I said, well, here I am. And I started writing, asking her the questions on the ballot. How are you going to vote? And she looked somewhat shocked and said, took a step back, and she said, well, she said, do I have to tell you that? And I said, well, yes, how do you suppose we get these figures? And she said, oh, I thought you did it with statistics. Well, the one question that comes to us more frequently than any other is this question of why haven't I been interviewed? And it takes all many different forms. Way back in the time of Hugh Johnson, He was always complaining that no one ever heard of anyone who ever heard of anyone who had been interviewed by one of our people. As a matter of fact, we get fewer today than we used to get, but we get a perfect stream of letters that come to the office, and people say, they always start out the same way. I travel through 6 states, and in the course of my travels, I talk to thousands of people, and I have never yet found anyone who was ever interviewed by one of your pollsters, one of your people. Well, that's the amazing part about this whole job. It's all based upon the laws of probability, which incidentally we didn't invent. But we know that after we have interviewed from a true cross-section a few thousand people, that it is absolutely useless to poll anymore, because if you don't have your answer then, you never get it. The Literary Digest polled some 10 or 12 million people and had an error in their last poll of 19 percentage points. We predicted that they were going to be wrong. It's one of the predictions that was practically 100% right. And we did it with 1,500 ballots sent to the same people that they were polling. But the amazing part of this business is that after you have talked to, let's say, 3,000 people, you can be within 1 or 2% of the true answer. And if you went on and polled 3 million people or 30 million people, you might increase that margin, that tolerance, from, let's say, 2% to 1%. But there would be it would make no more sense than it would do to have 100 horses hitched to a cart that could be pulled by one. Well, we have sort of a standard way of answering this question. When people ask why they haven't been polled, one standard answer is this. If we poll 10,000 people every week of the year, it would take us 200 years to get around once. There are just that many people, adults in this country, 100 million. Well, I happened to be at a cocktail party once, and in Princeton, and the wife of a lawyer come down from New York asked me this question, and I gave her that answer. And she said, well, I still don't understand. So I thought the real coup de grace was to say to her, well, your chances of being interviewed aren't much better than your chances of being struck by lightning. At which point she wheeled back and said, but I have been struck by lightning. And as a matter of fact, she had been. Well, now, we talk to people. We talk in an election such as this. We interviewed about 50,000 to 60,000 people from September on. The real art, science, polling is the science of selecting these people to be interviewed. And that is, if a poll is wrong, it's almost certainly wrong, because not because of the number of people included in the sample, but because of the selection of the people. In this sample, you have to have a true cross-section of the voting population. Now, most of our difficulties in the past, most of the experimental work, has had to be addressed to that problem. And in every election, and particularly in this last election, we used 3 different systems of sampling, 2 of them experimentally. You can do it. I won't go into all of the statistical aspects of this job, but you can select these people on the basis of census data and other information. You can include so many farmers, so many people in this of each in each occupational group, so many people with college education and so on. You can start out and design a sample that way, or you can pick people at random. And the best way to think of that system is this. Supposing that the name of every voter in the United States were included on a master list in Washington or some other place. And we went through this list, which included everyone in the United States, every adult in the United States, and picked every 10,000th name or 5,000th. Then we would have a true random sample of the United States. Or you can do it by picking small areas, small election districts at random. And when you do that, then you pick from the whole United States at random these small districts, precincts, wards, townships, which when added together give you, again, a true cross-section of the country. Now, without going into detail, let me say that this last system, which has been tried now experimentally in three elections and on a national scale this last time, but only experimentally, is the system which emerges as the best of all systems and with a remarkably small degree of error. So I think that while there are a great many problems, I'm ready to say that most of the problems in the field of sampling and in the field of election polling have been solved. Of course, you're going to have to wait to see if they have been. I looked at it in one way. Polling is simply a matter of counting noses. Looked at in another way, it's only a little less difficult than predicting what the market is going to do next Tuesday. Because you have to find out not only what people think, but then you have, in the case of an election, to find out which people are going to put that opinion into action. You have problems of turnout, deciding who will vote and who will not vote. You have problems of deciding how these people who will not give you their opinions or who are truly undecided, how they will vote. You have problems of trend. But most of those problems, I think, are in the process of being solved. Our biggest problem, our biggest difficulty in this field has been that these elections come so infrequently. If we were working in a laboratory, we could make a half a dozen experiments every day. But in this field, unfortunately, you have to wait 4 years between experiments. But I think we've finally gone through that stage. Now, let me get down to the real business here of telling you about my ideas on the election. I think it was one of the most heartening elections in the history of this country. And I think it was heartening for two or three good reasons. It seems to me that at crucial periods in the life of this country, at important stages, both parties have a way of coming up with great men. I think, and at least it's my own feeling, that you have to go back to 1916 to get two men of the stature of Eisenhower and Stevenson. Wilson used to be and has always been my hero. I live in Princeton, but even in the days when I lived in Iowa, he was my great hero. But Stevenson, to me, is a Wilson with a sense of humor. And I think that everyone would agree that Eisenhower is a man of great stature. So, at this crucial period in our history, the plain fact of the matter is that the people couldn't go wrong either way. But there were other aspects of this election which I think are worth noting. We have, since 1940, been telling the people about the low participation in elections in America. In 1940, I began making speeches pointing out that fewer people in the United States vote than in any major democracy of the world. And not only fewer vote, but very many fewer vote. In this election, nearly 10 million people more voted. I think that's a great thing. We still have some distance to go before we catch up with other countries, but that to me was one of the most important and encouraging aspects of this whole election. 60 million people vote. It means that 60 million people are interested in the problems and the future of the country. I would put down as a very heartening and encouraging fact the number of people who shifted their party loyalties. I think that blind party loyalty is probably more responsible for a bad government at local, state, and national levels than any other single fact. Theoretically and ideally, candidates, the issues, the platform should control one's vote and not the political views of one's ancestors. As a matter of fact, if you debase the whole democratic process to the level of a tribal custom, if you merely go on voting the way your parents have voted, and I'm thinking particularly of the people in the South, I think it's a wonderful thing when people decide that if they be Democrats, that they decide to vote for the Republican candidate, or if they're Democrats, they decide that the other man is the better man. And that is the basis of good government, I believe, in this country. Well, now, why did Eisenhower win? I think that one of the great factors in his victory was, I think the Republicans would make a great mistake if they wrote down that fact, if they thought it was a great Republican victory. As a matter of fact, they barely won the House. And Eisenhower's great landslide came about, I think, because he, as much of, I do not know of any man in history, certainly not in this century, who has had his popularity. And that popularity has been written, spelled out in literally 100 polls. I remember finding and reporting a year or two ago that Eisenhower could win on either ticket. Is there any man in the history of this country who could have won this election on either ticket? Well, he was in the pre-election, pre-convention polls. He beat everyone in sight. He had the advantage of being well-known. And as I say, certainly one of the great factors in his great landslide was this factor of popularity. Mr. Stevenson was relatively unknown. He came up as the election went along. In the pre-convention poll that we took in June of this year, Eisenhower beat Stevenson by the ratio of 59 to 31, with 10% undecided. In the final election poll, we had, if you leave in the undecided, 47% for Eisenhower, 40% for Stevenson, and 13% undecided. So you can see that Stevenson made progress, but he had a long way to go. Well, and now the remaining 4 or 5 minutes, and if you have any questions that you'd like to ask about other aspects of the election, I'll be glad to try to answer them. But in these last few minutes, I would like to make one or two observations. I remember one of the most important statements that I ever heard, I mean, one that had more effect upon my thinking, I believe, than any that I ever heard, came on an occasion exactly like this. I happen to think of that today when I was... In the year 1923, I was sitting in an audience just as you are today at a university lecture at the University of Iowa. And the speaker was a man by the name of Glenn Frank, who had been editor of the American Mercury, as I recall. Later, he was editor. He was president of Wisconsin University. And he made this observation, which incidentally was later credited to Raymond Clapper. But the man who made it first, so far as I know, was Glenn Frank. And he said, he made this statement, and I think it's one of the truest observations ever made about the American people. He was talking about editors, and he said that editors tended to underestimate the intelligence of the American people and to overestimate their stock of information. And in all the polling work that we've done, I think that observation is proved over and over again. You often, and most people, tend to underestimate the intelligence, the good common sense of the people, but to overestimate their stock of information. We find a great deal of ignorance in the country. It's disturbing on occasion. 2 or 3 weeks after the political conventions in Chicago, when all of the TV stations, radio stations, and newspapers had concentrated all their time, all of their newspaper space on the conventions, we found 2 or 3 weeks after the convention that only one person in four, one adult in four, could name the two vice presidential nominees. And they called Mr. Sparkman, Mr. Barkman, Spearman, and 60 other versions, and Mr. Nixon was, and we counted those all as right. We found that Mr. Nixon was Mr. Doxson and Noxon and whatnot. Now, I think that this lack of information is a serious matter. I think it's actually cost lives. We started a couple of years ago, to find out what people knew about South Korea. Well, oddly enough, only about one person in a hundred knows the population of South Korea and its manpower and military potential. In case you'd like to have me inform you, there are 22 million people in South Korea, but the interesting thing is that the people of this country, up until certainly the campaign of recent days, have thought of South Korea as a nation of 2 to 3 million people. And in a nation of 2 to 3 million people, an army of 200,000 or 300,000 is a very sizable army. But when you think there are 4 million men of military age, that's 18 to 45. When you stop to think that if South Korea drafted no more men than we did in the last war, they would have 2 million men in the front lines. Then you can begin to see another side to this whole Korean situation. In fact, I worked these things out. We did some polling on the subject. And I couldn't find anybody, no one in the country had ever published these facts. And I began to wonder if I were crazy. So I cabled Sigmund Rhee and said, "Is this true?" Now, this was many months ago. And I got a cable the next day saying, yes, that it was true, these figures that I've just given you, and that they would be glad to raise an army of this size if given logistical help, equipment, and so on. Well, I find that my time is up now, but I want to make one further statement here. And I feel very keenly about this. As a matter of fact, Joseph Batchelder knows how much time I've spent on this in recent weeks and months. And I want to talk about it because I want, first of all, to call your attention to a very interesting article that's in U.S. News of this week. It's an article about a young man whom I happen to know. It's one of their interviews, Frank Rounds Jr., who talks about life in Russia. Now, to me, the most disturbing fact of all about Russia, life in Russia, is some of the figures and facts that he gave in that review, in that article, on the reading habits and interests of the Russians. They queue up before the libraries. The libraries are so popular that they are kept open from 9 o'clock in the morning until 11 o'clock at night, 11:30. The people are hungry for knowledge. Now, in this country, we have 1,400 bookstores, real bookstores. There are 2,500, but 1,400 that are really can be described as bookstores. And that's in a nation of 156 million people. In Denmark, which has 4,300,000 people, about a 35th as large as this country, they have 650 and 350 secondary outlets. In other words, if we had as many bookstores in this nation as the Danes, we would have not 1,400, but 23,000. I think what we need in this country is an intellectual renaissance. And I think we should begin to think of learning as a process that continues through one's lifetime. In a study that we've just completed, we found that amongst college graduates, 1 in 4 had not read a single book in a 3-month period. 5 out of 6 had done no serious reading in the last few months. One hadn't read a book in 10 years. He said that... Now, this is a man walking around the streets of this country with a Bachelor of Arts degree. And he said that Longfellow wrote Origin of Species, and that Shakespeare wrote Canterbury Tales. And what I want to say by way of conclusion, I want to repeat a statement made by Sir Richard Livingston, who was the Vice Chancellor of Oxford. He said this: "Who can suppose that spiritual and intellectual growth ceases and knowledge and wisdom are finally achieved when a university degree is taken? Or that the need of knowledge does not grow more urgent with the passing of the years?" Thank you very much.
Seemed to be a large number of functionaries on the platform this evening. Quincy Howe to introduce Professor Batchelder, to introduce the speaker. Now a moderator. In view of the fact that many of those who are opposed to polls and pollsters are often quite emotional about their opposition, you might have thought this represented a bodyguard, but I assure you it's not correct. Now, there are no doubt a good many questions which you will want to ask. If you would, in asking the questions, stand so that I may choose in some order, and then state the question clearly, I'll transmit it to Dr. Gallup. Yes, sir?
I'm not very familiar with the type of questions you ask, but how high is the correlation between what people say they're going to do in an election and what you think they really do?
Could you repeat the question for the
record? The question was, how high is the correlation between what people say that they will do on an election and what they prove to have done?
Well, I think the correlation is very high. It's not only high in this country, but it's high in every one of the 11 countries where polling is carried on. I don't mean to imply that there aren't some people who purposely mislead you, but the best way to convince yourself of the honesty of people, the essential honesty, and the fact that they tell you what they honestly believe, what they really believe, is to go out and talk to them. If anyone has any doubts at all about any part of, about the public's carrying through or the public's statement of their opinions, then I would suggest that the way to discover that isn't true is, as I say, just go out and talk to them. I think the answer is that most people do. Now, there are people who refuse to give you their opinion. There are few, and that depends to a great extent upon the type of interviewing that's done. Some interviewers get more people refusing to answer their questions than others. A good interviewer will get an opinion from 95, 97 people in every 100. It's a function largely of interviewing.
Another question? Yes, sir?
Mr. Gallup, 1948, the polls proved that they're off, and they came a little closer this time. I'm wondering now, and read your explanation of 1948. Is that the same explanation hold true? Because you weren't quite so accurate in 1952?
The question, Dr. Gallup, was that as in 1948, the error which then existed was explained in terms of reasons for that error at that time. In 1952, were the same type of reasons involved in the error? Is that correct?
No, I think the error was of a different character in 1948. In 1952, we changed every single procedure that we'd followed in 48. In 48, I think there was a time factor. Well, that is one of the things that we have been able to lick. At least we've been able to poll up until about 4 or 5 days before an election. I think the error this time in the type of sample which we used came about largely through our own, through allocating the undecided 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 for the Democratic side, whereas the evidence all points to the fact that they divided about the same way as the people who had made up their minds. But I believe that out of all this experimental work, that we do have and have arrived at a type of sampling which we hope will lick most of these problems. Of course, that remains to be seen.
Do you sometimes use identical people for several successive polls, especially if you have to make polls on short notice?
The question, Dr. Gallup, was whether you use the same people on successive polls, especially when they have to be made on short notice.
As a matter of fact, we don't. Our interviewers are instructed not to talk to the same people, not to interview the same people during a period of the year. And the reason for that's very simple, because you can build up. If you did that, you could never build up your samples. This way, you can put the same question on succeeding ballots, and then you have expanded your sample by that much. So there are a good many other reasons for not going back to the same people.
Professor Aldrich, I'd like to ask if perchance that they, in taking any polls or post-polls, if they've determined how much Eisenhower's popularity carried any Republican senatorial candidate or congressional candidate through to victory rather than on the candidate's own merit.
The question was whether in any polls that were made, or in any post-election polls that have been made, whether there is substantial evidence that the popularity of General Eisenhower carried any senatorial candidates to victory.
Well, I honestly do not know how that could be answered. I mean, it's a matter of unscrambling this egg. I would think that the common sense would dictate that Eisenhower probably pulled a few Republicans to across the line. Of course, I don't know quite how you could solve that. I suppose that it'd be possible by making an elaborate study to determine whether that is true, but I have a feeling he probably did help. He undoubtedly did help some congressmen, some senators. And I think that's the chief reason, frankly, why the Republicans come up with this very narrow margin in both houses.
Yes, sir.
I would like to know what that indicates. And this evening, a more grown-up
student
than college students.
What is the question?
I'd like to know
from Mr. Gallup that indicates that this evening, more older people are present than college students. A member of the audience would like to know why, in this audience this evening, there are more older people than college students in your judgment.
Well, I would like to answer that. If time permitted, I would give my speech on education. I think we've done a marvelous job in this country of retarding the intellectual maturity of our young people. I think that we do, and I was talking with some of my friends tonight at the dinner table. I think that the time has come, frankly, when we should look into the whole system from top to bottom. I am concerned when I see, and when our polls in England and other countries show three times as many people reading books and being interested in serious things than the people of our country. It's disturbing. I think that our college students, I think the type of education that we give, which is quite different from the type you get on the continent, where students are given much more liberty and much more responsibility. I think our type of education, and I say this, I was a teacher for 10 years, I think our students are likely to say when they get through, well, thank God we're through with that.
The question is as to whether there is any evidence existing thus far as to why the undecided vote split differently this year than they did in 1948 and 44.
I think we'll have at least some kind of an answer to that when we finish these post-election studies. The answer may be in just our own sampling, in the different type of sample that we use this year. I think that maybe within the next month or two, when we finished putting together all of the experimental work that we've did during the campaign and this post-election polling that we always do, we may have a better answer than I can give you right now.
I would like to add, Dr. Gallup, that the increased vote this year that brought out materially helped Eisenhower to win.
The question is as to whether the large vote this year materially helped General Eisenhower to win.
Well, I know you can get into a violent argument on that point. There are two schools of thought. But I would have to say this on the basis of present evidence that the increased turnout, and I think even my good friend here on the right might quarrel with me on this. I think the increased turnout neither helped nor hurt. In all of the final ballots we use, we ask people. Question in addition to the others, the regular ones, that question was this: are you voting this year for the first time in a presidential election? Now, that doesn't separate persons. That brings in a great many young people, and it doesn't give. It may be that some of these people voted in an earlier election, didn't happen to vote in 1948. But I would say at this point that there's no evidence that it helped or hurt.
What technique did you use in 1956 to improve the accuracy of your prediction?
The question is, what techniques will you use in 1956 to improve the accuracy of your prediction?
Well, I can guarantee we'll use one system that we've tried first in 40, and then on a limited basis in 44, in a limited basis still in 48, I say limited in specific states, and this year for the first time, but experimentally, and that's a system which we call pinpoint sampling. It's the simplest of all the systems, and I believe it's will set the standard pattern for all polling, not only of our organization, but all other organizations from this time on. But you're still going to have to wait until, you don't have to wait until 1948, you can wait till 1954, the congressional election, because it will be used in the congressional elections in 54. Now, if it works, we have used it and did use it in 1950 in the congressional elections with the most accurate results in our entire history of polling. So I think the case has been definitely established for that particular type of sampling.
Yes?
How do you
Question is, how are interviewers secured, and what, in your experience, are the most important qualifications for interviewers?
We secure a great many of them, or most of them, through recommendations, teachers, superintendents of schools, editors. We hire some of them personally. The best interviewers usually are women, and mostly in their old age bracket of maybe, let's say, 25 to 40. Although we have a good many men interviewers, good many older people. But the people who are, first of all, conscientious, who approach the job in a factual, matter-of-fact, I shouldn't say matter-of-fact way, who like people. They have to like people, and they have to like the job, because it certainly doesn't, they'll never get rich interviewing. An interviewer is paid the equivalent of about $1.25 an hour, but lots of people like to do it. They don't like to do too much of it, but they like to do it on a part-time basis. We have about 1,000 interviewers, and they came through in a magnificent way in this last election. I mean, so far as any errors that were made in the office and not on the part of the interviewers.
Are you willing to answer about two more questions?
Yes.
Two more questions, Van Oyksen.
Dr. Gallup, do you think the American press should try and mold or lead public opinion, or should be more concerned than just reporting it?
Question is whether, in your judgment, Dr. Gallup, the American press should be more concerned with leading or molding public opinion, or should find its function in just reporting it?
Well, I think that about all they can do is to report public opinion. The efforts to mold it have never been too successful. If newspapers were able to mold public opinion, we would have had a series of Republican presidents beginning with Alf Landon. I think it's awfully hard. You can report opinion. You can report the facts on which people can base their opinions, but it's awfully hard to influence people. I mean, one of the early questions that used to come up about polling was that they charged us with starting bandwagon movements. They thought people saw that we reported a certain candidate ahead, or that a certain issue was favored by a big majority, that people would jump, quote, on the bandwagon. Well, we argued all of the evidence from the first day we got into this business indicated that that was not right, that that didn't work. And we had, if a half a dozen scientists had made an ideal test or set up one, they couldn't have found a better one than 1948, because not only all the polls were saying that Dewey was going to win, but all the newspapers, all the correspondents in America said he was going to win, and the people themselves said he was going to win. So
perhaps we should pick someone from this side. Are there any questions over here? This is an unresponsive half of the However, yes, Miss.
I was wondering if you would explain our 10 points.
question was whether you would explain, I take it briefly, a pinpoint system of polling, which you had stated as one of the best.
Well, the only difference, the chief difference between the pinpoint system and the other systems is that the interviewing is confined to small geographical areas, definite election units. In other words, townships or precincts for which we have the entire voting history. In other words, you can take the certain precinct in Champaign or Urbana. You know how that, if the boundaries haven't changed, you know how that district voted in this election, in the election of 48, in the election of 44, in the election of 40. And you can do just as the system of barometer counties is somewhat like this. I mean, here, barometer counties, which have somehow reflected the change of the trends in political sentiment over the years. If you take enough of these barometer counties, you're likely to be very near the mark. As a matter of fact, I wrote a piece in Look magazine early September on Jasper County. Well, Jasper County, Iowa, showed in those early days, showed Eisenhower winning by 2 miles. Now, Jasper County has always been, since 1900 certainly, has not only been on the right side in every election, but the figures, the division has always been almost exactly the division in the election. I haven't had a chance to, I know it was on the right side this time, but I don't know how far it came from the actual division. Now, if you took 200 Jasper counties, you see, only you don't have to take a county unit, you're taking a very small unit, a precinct, and that's the essential basis of this system.
I'm sure we all want to thank you for your facile and clear answers to the questions, and now, Professor Howe. That's all, I think. I'll thank both the more venerable and the more youthful members of the audience for their attendance this evening, and our heavy representation from the sociology department, which has so distinguished itself, and above all, to Dr. Gallup. And good night, all.